content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Martha Potter from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from Our State Magazine. Today's reading of Our State Magazine is underwritten by Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974 and underwriting this podcast for over 15 years. They can be reached at 919-781-1973. Today we will begin to explore the March issue of Our State Magazine. The theme for this month's issue is Where We're From, and it explores the rich ancestry, heritage, and traditions that have accompanied those who've chosen to make North Carolina their home. The cover of the magazine shows a mouth-watering picture of a barbecue sandwich, which is certainly part of North Carolina's heritage. The little blurb here is since 1962, when Wayne Monk opened Lexington Barbecue, a chopped barbecue sandwich with hush puppies has been a staple at the restaurant. First up is the welcome message entitled, Dear March, Come On In, from Elizabeth, the magazine's editor. Oh, how we've been waiting for you, the only month that is both a noun and a verb, an instruction, a direction, an encouragement to move, to stomp, to stride, to strut, to spring forward. March trots out a parade of woodland wildflowers, milky white and fire pink trilliums, poised along the paths near Pearson's Falls and Tryon Depot Garden in Saluda. Violets and lady slippers lie low in Nantahala National Forest and along the trails of the Eno River. Trumpet daffodils play their golden notes at Dorothea Dix Park. March. We traipse, tramp, tread on historic ground. In Greensboro, a living history reenactment recreates a turning point in the American Revolution at the Battle of Guilford Courthouse. In Four Oaks, we contemplate the Battle of Bentonville, where more than 4,000 Union and Confederate soldiers, brothers in our collective ancestry, lost their lives over three momentous days in March. In Like a Lion, March breathes and blows, its winds unpredictable and mercurial, a Shakespearean temperament. Never mind the Ides of March. On the weekend before that portentous day in 1993, the storm of the century barraged the state, 2 feet of snow piling up in West Jefferson, 3 in Blowing Rock, 4 on Mount Mitchell, a cyclonic superstorm of snow and gale-force winds that lingers in the memories of the North Carolinians who weathered it. But for all of March's ephemerals, we celebrate, too, the Eternals, the cyclical season of March Madness, a frenzy of basketball shoes scuffing, squeaking across the glossy hardwood courts of the Dean Dome, Cameron Indoor, PNC Arena, the Joel. In Fayetteville, the cadence of military life moves forward with a new tradition at what was known as Fort Bragg, a recurring evening event, the Sunset Liberty March, designed to honor all veterans past and present. On a half-mile path at the newly named Fort Liberty, designated Liberty Marchers, Gold Star families, service members, and veterans walk with civilians for a reflective tour past 39 markers that trace the history of the military base, from its installation as Camp Bragg to the stationing of the 82nd Airborne Division after World War II to humanitarian relief missions. Time marches on, an ongoing procession of seasons, sunsets, and sunrises. And in this month, after the full moon, Easter arrives, which brings us, say, to the mountaintop at Chimney Rock State Park, or to Wrightsville Beach, where for 75 years, congregants from 6 different churches have gathered, friends all, on the beach at first light. Or maybe we find ourselves somewhere solitary, say a front porch that overlooks a well-tended yard full of hyacinths and daffodils, just the way my grandmother's always was. The sunrise comes here, too, along with a cavalcade of birds, chickadees, wrens, goldfinches, and bluebirds, visitors who rest for a moment on tree limbs and then flit, whipping the air with their tiny wings, a drumbeat imperceptible to our ears. So many miracles to notice when we pause and stay still. And now I will take you on a descriptive journey through this month's pictorial essay, which is entitled Somerset Stories. The beauty and tranquility of a former plantation in Washington County belie its fraught past, but Somerset Place is telling its history honorably. Along the brick walkway separating Somerset owners' compound from the enslaved area, a century-old American elm tree grows through the white picket fence, defying boundaries set by man. And so you have a slight picture of the owner's compound of this former plantation, and then to the right there's a recreation of slave quarters. The past beckons. Where did we come from? Dorothy Sproul Redford's 13-year-old daughter, Deborah, was curious. Like so many American families in the winter of 1977, she and her mom were snuggled together in front of the TV watching Roots, the landmark miniseries based on Alex Haley's genealogical hunt for his African ancestors. Redford, unable to answer her daughter's question and inspired by Haley's work, soon embarked on her own decade-long journey into the past, one that would lead her from the dusty stacks of local libraries to the front porches of relatives in eastern North Carolina and ultimately to Somerset Place, the former plantation near the town of Cresswell in Washington County. It was against the backdrop of this endlessly flat, deceptively bucolic landscape that Redford's earliest family members in the United States toiled and sweat and bled, forced to dig a six-mile canal that would transform 100,000 acres of dense forest and swampland into fertile fields of rice, corn, oat, wheats, beans, peas, and flax. "I was here now at Somerset," Redford wrote in her 1988 book, Somerset Homecoming, Recovering a Lost Heritage. "I had the names. I had the place. I had to go on to piece together their existence as individuals, as a group, tiny slivers of reality, mere shavings of the past, disjunctive fragments of time." And for the pictures, across the walkway from Lake Hospital and the Suki Davis House right, which we'll hear more about that in a moment, is the Colony House, where the plantation owner, Josiah Collins III, where his children attended school. Today, it houses Somerset's Visitor Center. And the pictures displayed are, of course, of some picket fences, some pasture fences, and several buildings that are just plain clapboard buildings, no shutters. In some cases, even the windows have been boarded up with stone or brick fireplaces on either end. Shifting narratives. When Redford first set foot on Somerset soil in 1983, she found the plantation's official story lacking. It centered almost exclusively on the Collins family home, also known as the Big House, completed in 1839 for the family of third-generation owner Josiah Collins III. The only mention of the more than 800 enslaved people who worked the land, made families, and died here during the plantation's 80-year existence was a tiny wooden sign at the edge of a bare field that read, "Site of Slave Quarters." That changed in 1988 when Redford became site manager of Somerset Place. Today, current site manager, Karen Hayes, weaves in rich, full stories of many of the enslaved families, showing visitors reconstructed versions of the dwellings in which they survived. Eight members of the Collins family, plus a freed nursemaid and an enslaved housekeeper, lived in the 14-room Big House. By comparison, up to 15 family members occupied the one-room home of enslaved residents, Lewis and Judy. And the contrast is fairly significant. The big house, as it was called, is three stories. Well, two stories and then an upper story, which was probably the attic. It's got a screened-in porches on the back. It's got double-decker porch on the front. And in contrast to that, it's actually got three fireplaces, three chimneys, I should say, at least three chimneys, if not four. I can't see for sure. Contrast that with a windowless recreated house that is very tiny, A-frame structure, with one brick fireplace that's very tiny. Lives of the enslaved. Most enslaved families at Somerset Place lived in 18 by 18 foot one room cabins that were smaller than the children's rooms in the Collins's 6,800 square foot mansion. Inside one of those cabins, the plantation's horsekeeper, Sam, and his wife, Tamar, raised six of their children. They cooked, they bathed, they slept, all in this one tiny area, Hayes says, as she walks into a reconstructed cabin. She motions to the small bed pushed into a corner. The adults slept on straw mattresses and wooden frames. The children slept on the floor on corn shuck pallets, which would be removed in the morning and hung on the walls to free up the living space. The enslaved families would rise early to tend to their chores. In Sam's case, that meant feeding, watering, and exercising and grooming Somerset's horses and mules, cleaning their stalls and maintaining their saddles and other equipment. 7 days a week, 365 days a year. And for there's a picture of two freed slaves. Freed in 1865, formerly enslaved residents Augusta Anna Carter Cabarrus and James Limit Cabarrus Sr. married and eventually bought land of their own in Cresswell. Prior to emancipation, they lived in cramped quarters where efficient use of space was essential. And in the opposite page, we see a snippet of the interior of one of these slave dwellings, a very rudimentary bed. It is raised off the floor, but looks like a very thin mattress, a very thin pillow, and a bench, a well-worn bench, wooden floors. And no insulation, just the exterior boards are visible on the interior as well. A life of luxury. More than a half century after his namesake grandfather co-founded the Lake Company, which brought the initial 80 kidnapped West Africans to Washington County to begin building a plantation, Josiah Collins III and his family became Somerset's first owner residents. Their three-story Greek Revival mansion included lavish dens, which filled with musical instruments and ample space for the parties that Collins' wife, Mary, would throw. The house was positioned in such a way that the front balcony overlooked the carriage drive and the canal, and the back offered views of the 16,600-acre Lake Phelps, as well as the row of 23 cabins crowded with enslaved workers. By all accounts, Collins was extremely controlling of his enslaved population, some of whom tried to escape bondage via the woods or via the swamps. And we have pictures, actually rather somber looking, no smiling on these faces of these folks, Josiah Collins III and Mary Riggs Collins, looking very stern and somber. We see another picture, looks like with a school group visiting the house, a side view of the big house, as it's called, and then an interior view. When tour groups visit the big house at Somerset, they're able to peek inside rooms like the parlor, where Mary Collins hosted music recitals and reading circles. And in this parlor, we have gilt-framed portrait of perhaps one of the ancestors, or perhaps even Josiah Collins himself in later years. We have a harpsichord, which is open with music on it, and there's a window looking out over the gardens along with a settee that could be used during those parties. Fields of opportunity. In 1986, some 2,000 residents of enslaved families drove past the sprawling fields and canal that were once part of the Somerset plantation, imagining their great-great-grandparents bent over in the oppressively hot eastern North Carolina sun. Their destination, a Somerset homecoming that Redford had organized to bring together blood relatives who'd never met each other. Almost 40 years later, descendants still make pilgrimages here for reenactments, reunions, and even weddings. Wilson's brother, Charles L. Wilson, married his wife, Leslie Bell, at Somerset in 2003. The Wilsons were so moved by their connection to the area that they returned in 2019, this time in conjunction with an event hosted by the Slave Dwelling Project, which seeks to provide a deeper understanding of enslaved narratives across the South. The siblings spent a night on the grounds of Somerset. There was a fireside chat at night where we talked about the enslaved community, Wilson remembers. It was incredibly poignant. And we see on this page the fields and canal along Park Road outside of the modern-day Somerset were once part of the plantation. Located at what appears to be the end of the canal are cypress trees that border the Collins Mansion's private drive. And we see the fields and this and the canal there. Healing old wounds. When Wilson stepped inside the Lake Hospital building where her ancestors at Somerset came to heal from illnesses or wounds incurred during their long work days, she was shocked to see some of the instrument used to treat 19th century patients. For Wilson, Lake Hospital is also the building in which her own emotional wounds were treated. This is where she and several of her family members spent a night on the floor back in 2019. During the wee hours, Wilson and her sisters had to get up, put on their shoes, exit the building, and slog through grass, bugs, and the August heat just to get to a bathroom outside. At one point, we all just looked at each other, and we started laughing, she remembers. But it was a nervous laughter that was fraught with the realization that we were doing this for only one night. Her voice begins to break. We suddenly had this deep, undergirding appreciation that this is what our ancestors, Kofi and Sally, had to do every day of their lives. Enslaved residents suffering from dental emergencies, broken bones, or infectious diseases were treated at Lake Hospital. Inside were beds and a variety of primitive medical instruments, including tooth pliers and fracture boxes, used by 19th century physicians. And we do see the exterior of what was the Lake Hospital. Again, a very plain building, no shutters, with windows, with brick chimneys on either side of the house. The interior of the hospital doesn't look very different from the interior of the other slave quarters, where you see the outside boards are then with no insulation, no wall board or anything like that to finish the inside. You see the support structure and everything. And it is interesting to show a picture of this fracture box. It must be, it's something where it held the injured limb immobilized, I suppose, for healing. And there's white cotton straps around the outside, and inside looks to be some cushioning, perhaps a pillow. And I'm assuming that the injured limb was placed inside, and then the straps tightened as tightly as possible to immobilize the broken limb. It does not look like very comfortable, and the rudimentary tools do not look like they would be very pleasant to experience as well. The kitchen house. In the cookhouse, located adjacent to the Collins Mansion in an area called the Owner's Compound, enslaved chefs Grace Bennett and Lovey Cabarrus Harvey prepared the family's meals on wooden tables and cooked on an open hearth over red-hot coals. The circa 1808 building, said to be the oldest structure still standing at Somerset, was intensely hot as it also housed the laundry facility where enslaved sisters Annette Baum and Rebecca Horton washed, ironed, and mended the Collins family clothes. Today, school groups touring Somerset are invited to help staffers recreate early dishes made from cornmeal. And we do see a picture of the kitchen, the rudimentary. It's rather rudimentary, and some old stoneware bowls and cups and mugs and such as that, but not sophisticated at all. The wooden table is very old. A family's tree. Some of the dwellings for enslaved families were larger than others, but that didn't translate to more space, just more people packed inside. Take the Sukey Davis House, a two-story, 1,600-square-foot building that housed four extended families and a total of 26 people. Think of it as an apartment complex with multiple apartments in one structure, Hayes explains. On a wall in one of the rooms, Hayes traces Davis's lineage. Davis was purchased and brought here from Edenton in 1786. Once here, she had eight children, 45 grandchildren, 74 great-grandchildren, and four great-great-grandchildren. Hayes points to a pair of photographs, one of handsome Hardison Reeves and the other of his stern-faced sister, Rowena Reeves Bennett. These two, Hayes says with a proud smile, as if she were showing snapshots from her own family photo album, are two of Sukey's great-grandchildren. In 1843, Sukey Davis and 18 of her family members lived in three rooms of a two-story building, along with five members of an unrelated family. The cooking facilities of the enslaved homes paled next to those found in the kitchen, where the Collins family meals were prepared. Gardens of Plenty. An avid horticulturalist, Mary Collins designed the formal garden that separates the mansion from a cluster of gray outbuildings. Those buildings served various functions. In addition to the kitchen, there was a smokehouse, a salt house, a bathhouse, and two rations buildings where bulk foods and meats were stored and fresh herbs were dried. At one point, there was also a greenhouse where Mary cultivated rare plants from around the world. And you do have a very formal-looking garden with very nicely trimmed boxwoods that form a circle at one point, a semicircle at another point, a square, and inside each of those boxwood frames, if you will, are plants, a selection of plants are planted, and there are some brick walkways in there as well, all surrounded by a picket fence. If Lake Phelps could talk. Visitors to Pettigrew State Park, the roughly 17,500-acre recreational area that surrounds Somerset Place and Lake Phelps, may look out over the water today and see peace and serenity. But voices from the past are never far away. In pre-colonial times, before Europeans arrived to claim this land, native Algonquin peoples used the lake and its surrounding forest for hunting and fishing. In 1786, the Lake Company arrived with its original 80 enslaved Africans to dig the canal that connected Lake Phelps to the nearby Scuppernong River, providing a channel to drain the swampland in between. Today, this once inaccessible area of Washington and Tyrrell counties is open to everyone. And of all the state parks in North Carolina, its grounds may just be one of our most hallowed. Somerset Place is located on Lakeshore Road in Cresswell, North Carolina. Lake Phelps is the second largest natural lake in the state, behind Lake Manamasquite in Hyde County, and one of the oldest in eastern North Carolina. Archaeologists have located evidence of dugout canoes here dating back more than 4,000 years. and you can see the lake, and it's, of course, a rimmed along the edge of the lake are both deciduous and evergreens, mostly evergreens, it appears. To round out the remainder of our episode today, since I mentioned the cover showing a barbecue sandwich, actually from Lexington, but I'll read a quick article about Ed Mitchell. Whole Hog Hero, a famed Wilson County pitmaster, shares the stories and recipes that fill his life and plate. Long before nose to tail became a common catchphrase, black pitmasters like Ed Mitchell were cooking whole hogs in North Carolina's tobacco country. The same oak used to cure each year's harvest fueled the pits where pork slowly melted and crisped. Mitchell recalls that that process in his new cookbook, Memoir and Communal History, Ed Mitchell's Barbecue, which he co-authored with his son, Ryan Mitchell, and Wilson-born filmmaker and scholar, Zella Palmer. Mitchell traces the state's barbecue traditions back to plantations where the eldest enslaved man was called upon to cook at pig killings and was left with the less desirable parts of the hog. After emancipation, black communities cooked for themselves. Growing up in Wilson in the 50s and 60s, Mitchell joined the circle of Southern men who drank and sang and told stories as they cooked. Ed Mitchell's Barbecue is that kind of gathering, too. In reflections tucked among recipes for souse meat and sweet potato souffle, Mitchell tells his own story, how he was drafted and served in Vietnam, how the hog he cooked to comfort his recently widowed mother, Dorothea, launched the transformation of the family grocery store into one of the most celebrated barbecue businesses in the country. His loved ones share their stories, too. Ryan recalls childhood memories, while Dorothea advises readers on store-bought vegetables, second best, and self-respect, essential. Mitchell himself outlines how to honor the heritage of the pit masters who came before. I barbecue not because I love hoisting 150-pound hogs over my shoulders, he writes, but because I want to keep the tradition of my African-American ancestors alive. Ed Mitchell's Barbecue invites everyone to join him in tending that fire. Well, it appears we've run out of time for today's episode of Our State Magazine. I hope you've enjoyed it and that you'll be sure to listen next time. I'm Martha Potter for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's reading of Our State Magazine is underwritten by Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974. They can be reached at 919-781-1973. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. So long until next time.